Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we start the show by talking about adding winter interest to your garden. And our guest, Mark Dwyer, back with us. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, author, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and it's always great to talk with Mark. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your gardening questions or comments. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Let's start by talking about the winter garden. The gardens can be pretty boring at this time of the year. What's the first step in adding some interest?
Well, it's always a great question, Larry, because the reality on the ground in winter is it's certainly tough to compete visually with what we see in spring, summer, and fall. But I feel like we should be looking out on a landscape in our residential areas and elsewhere that offers a lot of extended interest and still has a lot of beauty to it. So this is the best time of year to examine a landscape and start thinking, boy, you know, I think I could include more ornamental grasses here, something with colorful stems, or, you know, the features of plants that become more prominent in winter when we're starved for that color. We can incorporate those into our landscape, but now's a great time to make those evaluations.
Yeah. Is there a good place to go for inspiration?
I feel like any public garden that's still open. And
yeah,
of course, when you're, you know, walking the dogs around your, you know, your neighborhoods, take a look, because some things are going to pop out, whether it's a beautiful conifer with a nice blue tone or something that's very textural. And granted, the eye tends to pass over a lot of our browns and beiges in these winter months, but there's certainly beauty to be found. So I love going to Olbrich Botanical Garden. It's fairly close to me in Madison, and they're open over the winter months to, whether you're enjoying the heat of the conservatory or hoofing it out through the gardens, there's a lot of things to be seen, of course.
Yeah, I kind of like to walk around outside and then go into the conservatory to kind of warm up. Favorite plants for adding color to your winter landscape? It kind of sounds like you do.
Well, I'm real big on conifers to start with because they become anchor points for the entire season. So the placement of a beautiful conifer should be doing something throughout the growing season. So it's a backdrop in spring, summer, and fall. But in winter, say something like a concolor fir with that beautiful powder blue tone is gorgeous. Or evergreens that get a nice yellow tint to them. I'm also a huge fan of colorful stems, whether they're from dogwoods, getting into the reds, oranges, and yellows. And there's a lot of great willows that are become cutback shrubs where their new vigorous growth throughout the growing season gets in a very intense coloration into the winter months. And my personal favorite is a willow called Flame. And its stems right now are the brightest orange-red you could imagine. You can see it from 100 yards away.
That would add a lot of interest. I don't have one of those. Maybe I should. Well, along with the plants, are there other design elements that you can bring to the winter yard to make it look more inviting?
Well, I think about my backyard as an example. Well, one of the things we like to do is add paint colors to different structures, vining structures, arbors, and that certainly combines with our growing season interest. But in winter, the fact that our garden furniture on the back deck is painted blue, that's a wonderful blue contribution. So it's non-living color. So when we think about our structures out in the garden, they can offer interest. But again, there's such a wide range of plant material, and there's nothing like a light snowfall, getting that pure white to kind of set things off. But don't ever hesitate to use non-living elements, as I call them, to offer additional interest as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. What about grasses for the winter? I grasses can add some winter interest if you leave them alone until spring. Is that okay to do, by the way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think it's important to mention, as I did with conifers, that, you know, with the use of with grasses, your placement and utilization should take into account spring, summer, and fall. But in winter, there's some wonderful grasses that have the stature to withstand snow and you know, the winter months, where they're offering interesting seed heads, movement, texture. I should mention not all grasses are created equal, so there's many of our perennial grasses lack that winter stature where they're flattened with the first snow. So know your grass for not only that, but what it needs from you in terms of soil and sunlight. But there's a great range of native grasses like big blue stem switchgrass, Indian grass, and then getting into some of the non-natives that have very strong winter presence and look great all the way till March when we start to cut them back and wait for that new growth to emerge.
What are some of those?
Well, some of the besides the native grasses I mentioned, there's quite a few miscanthus or maiden grasses that are quite nice, although there are some that are spreaders, so it goes back to knowing your grass. Some of the penicetums or fountain grasses, the majority of those are non-native. They offer some interesting kind of tufty flower heads into winter. There's very few grasses that will withstand, you know, a foot of wet snow. You know, just about everything gets flattened. But I love seeing grasses. I'm thinking about the healing garden here at Edgerton Hospital, where we're looking out on feather reed grass. That very, very narrow grass is looking quite nice and vertical. And the miscanthus I mentioned with the beautiful plumes, that's kind of our pampas grass equivalent in the Midwest. But again, knowing what grasses need from you, but there are some that are prone to reseeding. So it's important to know what you're getting into with certainly any plant you install.
And when you, I'm wondering, when you are purchasing those, I mean, you need to be a little careful because they're not always listed as being kind of invasive.
Right. Well, that's the real challenge, because you'll see a grass, the plant tag will say something like vigorous, exclamation point. And as a consumer, you're like, well, that sounds great. Of course, I want a vigorous plant. Well, that's one way of saying, you know, be careful. And a great example, and it's an amazing plant, but the switchgrass, the panicum called Northwind, which is Roy Diblick's selection out of Northwind Perennial Farm near Lake Geneva, wonderful, very upright form of the native switchgrass, absolutely gorgeous in the landscape, you know, 6 to 7 feet right now, just a nice amber color. In open soils, areas where you don't have mulch, this thing can reseed. It can be quite prolific. And switchgrass does that. That's how it spreads, by seed. And so in a landscape, I hear nightmare stories about trying to dig out switchgrass, but I have Northwind at home and here at the Healing Garden. And what we do is we put it in an area where there's quite a bit of mulch and we're not worried about the seed germinating. So there's a case of knowing your plant.
Are any of those, do you need to divide those at all or ever over time?
Yeah, great question, Larry, because the short answer is yes. As with many perennials, as they expand, most of the vigorous growth year after year is on the outer perimeter of that crown. So what a ornamental grass will do over the years is vacate the original center, the oldest portion of the plant, and the expansion is out in this, I call it a donut. So like literally as this plant emerges in spring with new growth, if you have a hollow center and just a ring of growth, it's time to divide, which is quite a bit of elbow grease with the larger grasses, but you can dig them up, slice and dice, and relocate. You can even recolonize that center if desired. But the danger in a donut for any type of perennial, and this happens with many perennials, they can be prone to being floppy and you're kind of missing something in the center. So look for donuts in your spring garden, folks, but grasses will need that division.
And your favorite grasses, again, are...
Well, I love those panicums, that Northwind switchgrass I love, but there's a lot of great big blue stem is common in our prairies. There's a wonderful big blue stem called Blackhawks, which in summer turns deep, deep maroon. It has an amazing late season fall color. So Blackhawks, big blue stem, Northwind, panicum, and the Indian grass or sorghastrum, there's a variety called Sioux Blue, and that's Sioux as in Native American tribe, S-I-O-U-X, blue. And it's this steely powder blue in the landscape on a 6 to 7 foot tall grass. So I tend to lean into the natives, but go to your local garden centers and certainly envision where these can be placed for winter interest, but also contributors throughout the season.
Mark Dwyer with us today. His business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. We're taking a look at color for all the seasons and certainly answering your gardening questions as we move along, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. Give a call, shoot us an email. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR. On this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Mark Dwyer, his business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. And again, questions for him, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Don emailed to ask, what kinds of grass or ground cover do you recommend for a low-mow lawn?
Well, low-mow lawns are becoming really big. The idea that you have shorter stature grasses, perhaps some forbs, some bloomy material that combines to create this sort of matrix or mat that either needs very little mowing or maybe even once a year. And I would encourage folks to visit Olbrich to see their meadow gardens and see what they've utilized for shorter grasses. There's a wide range. It kind of depends on what height works for you, but there's a wide range of sedges and even native grasses that stay in that lower portion. And I've seen a huge focus on using something called autumn moor grass, or Cecillaria, is a great lower stature grass. And it's a nice clumper, so you can use these in tandem. But a great example of larger spaces that, again, include a mixture of different plants to create a low-mow situation can be found at Olbrich, and they really do it well.
Yeah, they do indeed. Mary Ann in Green Bay is wondering, what cold-tolerant annuals can you recommend for her planters? She's done pansies to death.
Yeah, no, I have some ideas, and certainly bop over to the Green Bay Botanic Garden, which is exceptional as well, and I'm sure you'll see some great examples. But when you think of containers, it's great this was brought up, because a lot of folks consider containers as a post-Mother's Day, what am I doing for summer? But think about bookending your containers with cool season plantings in the spring or in the fall. So you're starting earlier, of course, and aside from pansies, which are really short-lived perennials, and the wide range of violets you can purchase, consider focusing on cold-tolerant greens. There's a lot of neat mustards, like purple-leaf mustards, a lot of the cabbages, kales, chards. So there's a lot of greens you can put into early containers that are also edible. But in terms of flowering annuals, independent of pansies, I rely on Nemesia, and that's N-E-M-E-S-I-A, Nemesia, very cold-tolerant. There's Linaria, L-I-N-A-R-I-A. Linaria is used extensively at Olbrich in their very early containers. And these are plants, again, that won't mind 50 to 60 degree days and 37 degree nights. They won't like a hard frost, but when you go to your local garden centers, ask for those cold-tolerant annuals, because they're frequently available in March, because you're putting them in April, to bookend the season. So again, look for Nemesia, Linaria, and some cool season greens to augment your containers.
Yeah, this is good advice. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the kind of roller coaster weather that we've had here in Wisconsin and across the country for that matter. What can we do to protect our gardens in weather that's like a roller coaster? Anything?
It's really difficult. You know, I think about the fact that we have almost no snow on the ground in the Janesville area, and we're heading into another really cold spell. So there's not a lot of that winter blanket of snow is something I always like to have, to be honest. But I'm at the point where I'm putting up some burlap, some stakes and burlap around some of my evergreens, because I'm concerned about winter burn. Just very cold, desiccating winds. And again, we had kind of a dry late summer into fall, too. So I feel like we're still down on precipitation from the end of last year. So in larger scale landscapes, Larry, there's not a lot you can do. And Mother Nature always seems to sort it out, and I'm always pleased that I don't see more damage than I expect. But we still have a lot of winter left.
I guess so. There's a lot of time left for this winter yet. Well, what should you do if one of your plants or shrubs seems dead in the spring?
Well, adequate water becomes important, and don't be too quick with a shovel for removal. If I see a shrub that looks dead, I tend to scratch and bend the stems. If I see any green or pliability, that's a good sign. If it's dry and snaps, that's not so good. But I still wouldn't remove anything until you start heading into later May and June, because you may have some just late foliation and a stress plant that still might recover. So, you know, you thin the herd a little bit later in season once you see what's happening. But if the plants are hardy, hopefully they'll make it through. It's just tough to say with, again, some these temperature fluctuations, as you've mentioned, Larry, are disconcerting.
Yeah, they are indeed. Mark Dwyer, our guest. Questions for him? I hope he'll join in. Kind of quiet today. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned the Healing Garden, and your manager of the Healing Garden at Edgerton Hospital, which we've talked about a number of times, and I haven't been down there to see it yet. I want to go. What do you do with the garden in the winter? Is it still used in some fashion?
Not necessarily. I guess I should say both yes and no. So not actively, because concerns with snow and ice, we try to keep it relatively clear, but I feel it's being used because the hospital was positioned to have primary views from the rehabilitative wing and the therapy wing right into the garden. So people are still looking out on a beautiful winter landscape, which we've been talking about, but we don't see a lot of active use until March rolls around.
Megan in Eau Claire is interested in adding rhododendrons to her landscape. Will they grow in her area, and what do they require?
Yeah, rhododendrons and azaleas, which are very closely related, they would be hardy in Eau Claire, but you have a smaller palette than you would certainly further south or in the southeast United States. So I would talk to the garden centers in your area, because there is a list of rhododendrons that are quite hardy. The challenge isn't so much the cold of winter. They're just very particular with soils. So it's an issue of they thrive in acidic soils. So when I was at Rotary Gardens, our rhododendrons and azaleas all had a lot of TLC with soil preparation, sharp drainage, acidified soils. And you give them actually more sun than most people relegate them to shady locations, and they are quite shade tolerant. But getting some degree of sunlight is really vital for them filling out and having their best blooms. So get a little more consultation locally, but you absolutely can grow those plants if you can commit to that TLC I mentioned.
Let's take some calls. Don in Wisconsin Rapids, what's on your mind?
Just looking for native plants to create a little bit of a nice look, but also a barrier for sound between our residents and our road that we're adjacent to. Not a lot of sound year-round, a lot of traffic, agricultural traffic being in the country, a lot of equipment moving and things of that nature, and just looking for a natural sound barrier instead of putting up a man-made one, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, great question, because when you think about how sound travels, particularly in winter, the idea of incorporating native plants makes sense, and you would start leaning into, of course, height is a big thing for deflecting sound. So you start leaning into some of these taller native grasses we've talked about. And I would encourage you to chat with Prairie Nursery over in Westfield and see what they might recommend, because the challenge isn't so much finding taller plants. It's just making sure you have a combination that works together, where you don't have plants that become overbearing or take over. But if you have any opportunity to incorporate native conifers, like the native juniper, Juniperus virginiana, which is eastern red cedar, having some evergreens will provide some of that deflection as well. So you could pepper in some woody plants. And there's a wide range of native woody plants that, hand in hand with herbaceous material, these grasses included, would be a nice composition to consider. But again, Prairie Nursery may get you started with some of the perennials. For sure.
Don, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Elizabeth in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Because I was familiar with red and yellow twig dogwood, it's a nice contrast in winter when there's snow on the ground, because the twigs, the color of the twigs really stands out with the snow.
Good points. Comment on that, Mark.
You know, winter's the time to appreciate those, because their best intensity of stem coloration, and this is red twig and yellow twig, is when the leaves drop and fall and then the sun hits them. They really get intense. But I will say, if you're into that, the winter coloration of both red and yellow stem dogwoods, consider their summer look, because there are some variegated selections where the foliage has a nice crisp variegation. And so you get the benefit of the ornamentality of those leaves. And so when I, all my colorful stem dogwoods I utilize, I lean into variegation. Like red stem dogwoods, there's one called Ivory Halo, great white variegation. Yellow stem dogwoods, there's a beautiful one called Silver and Gold, which has variegation and also that bright yellow stem color. So, but excellent comment by the caller. The intensity, even on, particularly on a day like today, is amazing, but the snow sets it off for sure.
Yeah, good points. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Joe in Arlington. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Quick question regarding the ornamental grasses. How susceptible are they to deer turning them into nothing but dust?
That's a common question for just about every plant here in Wisconsin, for sure. It really depends on the grass, but most are resistant, particularly those native grasses. So when I mentioned big blue stem, there's also little blue stem, prairie drop seed, switchgrass, Indian grass, very resistant to browsing. And if there, any browsing occurs, the regeneration is quite quick. So I don't, ornamental grasses as a category, I don't see a lot of deer browse, to be honest, in my situation in southern Wisconsin. So I feel comfortable saying I don't feel you'll regret planting them because of that potential problem.
Yeah. Joe, there you go. Thank you. Let's turn to Jeanette in Darlington. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. Good morning. My husband is a beekeeper, and I do biology, and he and I also work on doing some small little plots here and there for replenishing some native prairie, as well as some woodlands. And something we've noticed with the beekeeping, with our honeybees and a lot of the native bumblebees and things, they are very sensitive to not only the insecticides, but also fungicides. So something I'd started several years ago, if I was looking to buy plants at big box stores or even some of the nurseries in hardware stores, I would ask them if their plants are treated with neonicotinoids, because even if it's something that you've bought, it stays systemically in those plants and can be harmful to our beneficial insects.
Jeanette, thank you very much for calling. Mark, I'm sure you have a comment on that as well.
That's amazingly great advice that everyone should heed, because the neonicotinoids, and feel, do a Google search on this, folks. So neonics, as they're called, as a caller mentioned, they're integrated into the plant. And the intention in their use is to grow these plants for purchase without problems. But the issue is that neonics affect the nervous system of our pollinators. So bees that are coming to these petunias later on are affected adversely by those chemicals. So I'm not sure about current EPA branding or labeling, but I've seen labels that have indicated whether neonicotinoids have been used or not used. So ask those pointed questions. And it can be as simple as saying, what's the history of these plants? What have they been treated with? Because you don't want to carry that chemical input into your home landscape and adversely affect our native pollinators. Nobody does. So be a little more informed on your purchases, folks. And I think that's a great comment to, again, to heed when you're out in spring buying.
Absolutely. Let's turn to Janine in Fond du Lac. She emailed. She has numerous mandevilla vines that she's wintering over in the house. In the spring, she'll plant them outside to grow on an arbor. And her question is, should she plant them directly in the ground or should she leave them in pots and plant the pots into the ground?
Well, that's a, you know, mandevilla is absolutely beautiful, and it's nice to hear. And for anyone who ever purchases mandevilla and the closely related diplodenia, they're pretty much the same thing. But these gorgeous tropical vines, you want to perpetuate them year after year. Don't put them for one season and then put them in the compost pile. Bring them inside, as this caller has done. But with mandevilla, you can plant them directly in the ground, but if you keep them in their existing container, whether you insert that in ground or leave it above grade, you can be a little more in control of that warming up quicker, and also fertilizer applications become important because mandevillas are heavy feeders. Not so much with nitrogen, which would be a lot of stem and foliar growth, but a nice balanced fertilizer in that container or in the ground would encourage more blooms. If you're doing your mandevilla in the ground, I would directly plant it in the ground, I would amend that soil heavily with compost, make it nice and rich. But either option in a nutshell is really fine.
Let's go to Paula in Green Bay next. Hi, Paula.
Oh, good morning, guys. I have a question regarding when to cut back native grasses. I've got quite a few in my different gardens, and I keep them up through the winter for native insects and this, but then I keep hearing, all right, don't cut them back too soon in the spring, and then I feel like I wait too long, and there's green stuff. And so when is the optimum time to cut them back?
Question. And with grasses, there's both cool and warm season grasses, and that really relates to when they start emerging from the soil and ultimately growing. That's neither here nor there, because once you start seeing any growth, that's the latest time you really want to start cutting. So that'll vary depending on Mother Nature and where you are latitude-wise in the state. So what I like to do is I'm typically cutting grasses in later March, early April, as it's warming up. And don't let a warm day in February fool you where you're like, I'm just going to go get those grasses, because they're still offering interest, and there's a likelihood that some of our native pollinators or insects might be sheltering within that debris. So cut grasses back as late as you possibly can. And a great example, Olbrich, I've mentioned a couple times in Madison, they don't start cleaning up many of their grasses or garden beds until April, because they want those pollinators to hatch out, do their thing before it gets too warm. But once you start seeing any sort of active growth, definitely get in there and chop away.
Paulo, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Jim, who's on the Wisconsin-Illinois border. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Many years ago, I went with the DNR here in Illinois. On, I had an 8-acre hay field that I used for animals, and we got rid of, didn't have any animals anymore. And I put it in a tall grass prairie, and I've got big blue stem and little blue stem and switchgrass and Indian grass. And I try to burn it every year, every spring. And this last year, I didn't get a chance to because of the winds and stuff. I was surprised how it come back this year without burning it. But my neighbor to the east of me, is in, she's got a probably a 5-acre field there across the fence from me. And she's soon to have a Indian grass prairie of her own.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great comment. First of all, I applaud you on having that much acreage with these native grasses. And don't worry if you miss a burn. At Rotary Gardens, we had a small prairie restoration, and we would burn it every 2 or 3 years, and that seemed adequate, you know, with it, that ash dropping. The reason, other reason for the burn is to get out some of the invasives like multiflora rose and things that shouldn't be there, hopefully get burned out. But to the comment about the Indian grass moving over to your neighbors, that's one of the challenges. Switchgrass and Indian grass in particular, and big blue stem to a certain degree, can be prolific reseeders. And so in terms of reproducing, they're producing a ton of seed. And as it's dropping or floating on the breeze, when it finds open soil, it germinates. So in a prairie situation, everything sort of balances out. They're fighting for root space and real estate. So that's why you don't get, you know, prairies that have been done well. aren't dominated entirely by grasses, but they certainly can gain a foothold. So that's something for people to keep in mind in their residential scale, as well as going back to knowing the grass.
Yeah, good point. Jim, I bet you that provides a lot of pleasure for you over the course of the year.
And, the wildlife, especially, you know, when that stuff is 6 and 7 foot high and we get these cold winds like this, them deer and stuff, they really hunker down in that.
Oh, sure. I bet it does. I would love to see your prairie there. It sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. I had on my show this past week, Lynn Peoples, and she had written a book called The Inner Clock, and it was about circadian rhythms. And one part that we didn't get a chance to talk about when she was on with me was the biorhythms and circadian rhythms of plants. And she was talking, she slept in a sunflower field once to watch the sunflowers. And the sunflowers, the heads of the sunflower plant would be facing east in the morning, and the heads would follow the sun, and the heads would be looking west in the evening. And she slept there because she wanted to observe them. They turn overnight to then again the flower heads face the sun, and of course they're facing the sun. And when the sun comes up, then the insects come in and grab their nectar and all of that. And I thought it was an interesting. She also talked about how certain flower species open and close their flowers each day pretty much at the same time. And one of the horticulturists she talked to said you could, if you didn't have a watch, once you knew the time of day that they opened and closed, you could pretty much go give yourself a pretty good estimate of what time it was just based on the circadian rhythm of the plants. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
It's amazing. And I've heard of folks creating these floral clocks where not an actual clock made of flowers, which can be done, but the fact that putting different plants that open at different times, and a great example would be the annual what we call 4 o'clocks or mirabilis. They truly open around 4 p.m., which is really amazing. So I don't pretend to understand all of that, but I wouldn't mind hanging out in a sunflower field and watching that happen.
She's up there. She's talking about being up at getting out of her sleeping bag at 3 in the morning, you know, just checking over the course of the night to and then sort of watching the plants actually move toward their position, yeah, so they could be positioned exactly east when the sun came up. It was fascinating story. Betty in Middleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I'm calling to see, is there any new developments in controlling or killing jumping worms?
Boy, maybe you've heard more, but all I know is that UW-Madison continues to really be on the forefront of the research. And so I'm not aware of anything new, to be honest. And I know it's still problematic for many people. And if you're a listener and you're not familiar with jumping worms, do a little research on it because it's pretty scary. But I feel like there'll be some solutions coming down the pipe in the next 10 years, hopefully.
I hope as well. Betty, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Mark, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. It was kind of short notice, and I really appreciate your expertise and your willingness to be on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Mark Dwyer with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He does a lot of consulting work, but he's also the healing garden manager at Edgerton Hospital. Mark Dwyer, his business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Well, we got a cold spell coming up here, and it's in parts of the state it's been cold a lot more than it has in the south. And what effect has that had on the trees? We'll talk about that next with our expert, Paul Segan. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk. Today we are going to turn our attention to trees and cold weather. Weather plays a big role in the health of your trees, and we'll be talking about how to look for cold weather damage, how winter weather impacts forest pests, and then look ahead to spring and tree planting with our guest, Paul Segan. Great to be able to see Paul again. He's DNR Forest Health Specialist and works out of northern Wisconsin, and he's got answers to your tree questions for sure. And let's join in with some of those questions. What concerns do you have about winter weather in your trees? Maybe a question about emerald ash borer. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Paul, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Excited to be here, Larry. Here we are in the middle of winter, and who would have thought we're going to be talking about trees? But there's a lot to think about for our trees here, because winter is an important stage of life trees have to get through. And if we can help nurse them along in some cases and protect them, they can be all the happier when that warm weather comes back.
You know, it's really interesting. It's been another interesting winter. You know, today in southern Wisconsin, it's 40 degrees or so. Tomorrow, it's going to be somewhere in the area of a low of -2, fluctuating temperatures. What are those fluctuating temperatures have on our trees' health?
Yeah, so when we see these fluctuating temperatures, we really don't think about good effects on trees generally, because what can end up happening is when we get warm-ups that are somewhat extended, trees like conifers, you know, arborvitae, hemlock, other conifers can actually start to activate at the cellular level under the presence of sunlight and warmth. When we're above freezing, those trees can actually start to photosynthesize. They can start to lose moisture through their little water conducting tissues on the surface. And sometimes it's hard to replenish water if there's frost in the soil, which usually is the case in winter. And so when we get that dramatic swing in temperature, we can see some damage from things like desiccation or drying out of the tissues and the lack of water uptake in the roots. So generally, we like constant temperatures in the winter for the health of our trees.
Yeah, I was talking a bit about that with Mark Dwyer. And Mark brought up the fact that he loves to see a snow blanket. Now, you may have a little snow in northern Wisconsin. I know there's some. But in the south, many areas of the south, we have no snow, zero snow in the state. How does that snow cover can be a help, can it not? And what happens if we don't have it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're kind of going into winter very similar to last winter in terms of some of the temperature and snow levels. Last year, recall, was dubbed the lost winter because we had so little snowfall, and it was the warmest on record in Wisconsin since records have been kept. And we're kind of shaking out in that direction, though it does seem the La Nina is sort of setting up a little bit more with this extended forecast of cold temperatures. But snow really does play an important role, particularly with protecting fine roots from frost damage. As it starts to get colder in the fall and the frost sets in, it penetrates deeper and deeper into the soil as the winter goes on generally. And if we don't have a snow blanket whereby snow might fall and kind of allow some of the frost to actually recede and move upward in the soil profile, or just protect the soil from having frost penetrate so low, it can then lead to roots that end up getting frost nipped or damaged. You know, the root tips can end up getting damaged, and certain roots that grow a little bit lower, they don't prefer that really cold temperature around frost. And so we can occasionally see, as a result of low snow, root mortality. Now, this was something that happened back in the 2002-2003 winter, where we had very cold temperatures and limited amount of snow. And what was noted the following season after that was dieback in some of the both the hardwoods and conifers, whereby we lose some of the outer twigs and branches. And that's not really a good thing, because that can stress the tree out and make it more prone to insect or disease infections.
Unfortunately. Sam in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Sam, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So I had a tree taken down on the boulevard, a little amount of grass between the sidewalk and the road, and the city put back in some smaller saplings, maybe like 10, 11 feet tall, wondering what sort of winter care might help them out for next year.
Do you know what type of trees they were, Sam?
I think one is an aspen and one escapes me.
Ash, maybe? Aspen for sure. Okay.
Yeah, when we're talking about that kind of very, very concentrated urban environment around a boulevard and sidewalks in close proximity, the one concern I have is with de-icing salts and the potential effect on causing too high of a salt concentration in the soil. As it warms up, some of the water can run off higher concentrations of salt, and those can accumulate in the soil around which that plant is growing, and that can eventually become toxic to the tree. So a better approach is to use a more environmentally friendly de-icing salt if you're salting your sidewalk in that area. So that can be a help for sure. The other thing is really thinking about mulching. Young trees, new plantings really benefit from having, you know, 2 to sometimes up to 6 inches of mulch that is a little bit away from the stem of the tree, and that goes out to the drip line. The drip line is really the furthest outer branch, how far it extends outward from the tree. That zone really benefits from having that mulch addition, because that will provide a bit of a thermal buffer against these cold winter temperatures. And in the spring, it will also provide like some nice nutrient cycling as that tree starts to grow again and dormancy recedes. So I think mulching is a good idea. I think be concerned with de-icing salts and using more environmentally friendly concentrations of salt.
Yep, good points. Sam, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Ron in Manitowoc County will go to you next. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Larry. Paul, I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for replacing ash trees in low areas other than swamp white oak and tamarack.
Ron, what part of Wisconsin are you looking at?
East Central.
Manitowoc County.
East Central, that's going to open up your options a little bit, because we're not as in a far northern hardiness zone. So off the top of my head, some things I could potentially think of might be a sycamore. Sycamore is not generally going to grow naturally that far north, but with the idea of assisted migration and promoting some of these species that might be climate adapted to further areas of the north as we get some trends in warmer weather, that might be something to look at. Hackberry is a very good low-lying species. River birch is known to grow very well in these kind of floodplain areas. And of course, silver maple can grow quite good too. I think what maybe we could do in the show notes, Larry, is set up a little article with more options if we wanted to. But there's plenty of low-lying both conifers and hardwoods that could be selected.
All right, Ron, there you go. There, I think 4 or 5 recommendations there for you to take a look at least before you make up your mind. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Tiffany in Madison next. Hi, Tiffany.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a bunch of arborvitae that I've been watching grow for 3 years, and I love them. And some hungry little animal, whether a rabbit or a squirrel, I don't know, but came and ate the bark off of a bunch of them. And on one of the trees, they made it almost all the way around the tree. So it's a small tree, probably a 3 or 4 inch diameter, and there's really only about a 3 or 4 inch strip of bark left on the outside where they didn't chew all the way around.
Mm.
And my neighbor had the same thing happen to his apple tree.
Oh, boy. So
yeah.
What can she do?
Yeah. The dreaded animal damage is always one that a number of folks deal with each winter, and there are some strategies to deal with it. Usually it's obviously better to deal with on the front end before we get the damage. In your case, Tiffany, it's hard to say if there's going to be survival of that heavily damaged stem. Now, you said that it's girdled or kind of consumed tissue, bark tissue, around almost the whole circumference of that stem. That's going to make it hard for it to recover, but I wouldn't pull the plug on it just yet. I wouldn't cut it down or anything until you can see potential recovery in the spring once it breaks bud, if at all, and maybe tries to recover with some new growth. That being said, how do we prevent things like that from happening in the first place? And really, we're talking about putting protective, usually mesh cloth, around the stems of trees. And depending on what kind of animal we're going to deal with, whether it's mice or whether it's a rabbit, we might have different, or a deer for that matter, we'll have different heights of that mesh protection. If we're talking about mice, which are mice and voles, which are common and dwell closer to the ground, we're going to really want to bury that mesh protection. Basically, we're thinking about wrapping a piece of metal mesh that's about a quarter inch size holes around the whole circumference of the stem. And we want to bury that 2 to 3 inches below the surface in the case of mice or voles, because we know they can dig a little bit. And we're going to wrap that around the tree. It's going to be about 6 inches away from the stem. When we're talking about rabbits, we want to think about, well, rabbits can be a little bit, they can get on their hind legs, and they can be a little bit taller. So we want that mesh to be about 24 inches above where we expect the snow level to be. So quite a bit taller in the case of rabbit protection. And in the case of deer, well, if deer get really hungry, they are hard to keep out because they get really just adverse. They're not very susceptible to fear, and their hunger overwhelms that and any kind of repellents we might put on trees. So we would probably need sturdy fencing to keep deer off, usually around 8 feet tall. Sometimes they can even jump over that if they get a running start. So metal mesh for the smaller animals and heavier duty fencing when it comes to deer.
Tiffany, does that help out?
So there's nothing I should put on the remaining, like the exposed wood, to protect it?
No, I would not do that. When we're talking about pruning sealants or other coverings, that's usually, most of them are phytotoxic and they can inhibit the formation of callus and healing tissue on the tree. So I would just leave it alone. If there's any bark that looks real ragged and kind of hanging loose, you might take a pruner or a clipper and clip some of that off, any excess bark that's just loose and dead. But beyond that, I would just maybe try to protect the rest of it with that metal mesh guard and see what happens in the spring.
Yeah, there you go, Tiffany. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul Segan, our guest, a DNR forest health specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. We're answering your tree questions. We've been looking at the impact of winter on our trees, but of course, we can talk about what happens with your tree in a whole variety of other ways, whether it be insects or what have you. And you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. Paul will be with us right to the bottom of the hour today, and then we'll talk about with another guest about lighting, indoor lighting for your plants. But right now, we're talking trees with Paul Segan. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here as we talk trees on Garden Talk with Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. Great to have Paul back. And as we visit with him, I hope you'll join in. What concerns do you have, maybe about tree disease? Or maybe you need some advice on planting or pruning, or maybe this winter damage that we've been dealing with and talking about on the show. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or shoot an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Keith in Lake Wisconsin has something for us, Paul, so let's go there. Keith, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. Paul, last summer we planted about a 3-inch diameter matador maple in our front yard and did the, you know, dug out an extra large hole, put in the mulch out to the drip line, all that, staked it, and it looks like it's doing well. My question is, going into the spring, what should I be looking for any potential problems, and what should I do about fertilizer or any other special care going into its first full season in our yard?
Okay.
Yeah, great question, Keith. Yeah, so the one thing that stood out when you said that was the maple, the matador maple. And one thing I know about maples is that they are thin-barked, and that sets them up for a higher susceptibility to a type of damage called sunscald. That is when portions of the bark that are exposed to south-facing sun or western sun, southwest sun, can end up getting damaged on the stem, and it can lead to an area of dead tissue, what we would call a canker on the stem. And trees can survive it and heal from it, but we generally want to avoid it. So one idea might be to put a protective wrap around that tree for the first few seasons. You could use like a white reflective wrap that would go around the stem of that maple, or you could also use a white guard that would both protect it from some of the animal feeding risk that we talked about with rabbits and mice, but also provide it a little bit more consistent temperature and protection from that sun. So that would be one thing you still might, you know, still might consider doing this winter, and then for sure the next couple, as this is still a young tree establishing. As we get into the spring, of course, you don't know what types of injury might have occurred with the maple. You hope for not a whole lot, but you won't know until you start to get leaf out and leaf expansion, and those buds really start to expand and show you what that tree's overwintering tissue had to deal with. And so at that point where we get into maybe early June and you're starting to see leaf out, you might see some of the branches got some dieback in them. That would be a good time to prune out the dead material twigs and branches down to the point where there's still living tissue. So dead wooded, essentially, would be a good idea. And then in the spring is a good time to fertilize, too. Once we start to get the thaw, the ground is pretty much unthawed and we're getting some rain coming down. Spring fertilization can help with that tree. Of course, if some of the mulch may have got compressed or maybe washed away or decayed, or it wasn't as thick as you thought it was when you applied it in the fall or summer last year, maybe add some supplement to that mulch too. About 6 inches out from the stem, all the way out to the drip line, the furthest reaching branch of that tree, you know, anywhere from 2 to about 4 inches of mulch would be good. So a little bit of supplementation, a little bit of monitoring, and then still some preventative action with that wrap or that guard that you could put up to prevent sunscald.
And when it comes to the fertilizer, is there anything in terms of nitrogen, potassium, you know, what sort of fertilizer should you be using, Paul?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the soil in an area. And so, of course, you know, you want to kind of get a soil test to see if there might be any nutrient deficiencies in that particular region or that particular environment it's planted in. But if the soil test comes back and it's pretty much an average soil, I think a balanced fertilizer that balances nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, that NPK, those big letters at the top, would be a good idea. I tend to like natural fertilizers like fish emulsion that have basically just ground up fish parts and matter. It's usually a 5-1-1, so it's a heavier blend toward nitrogen, but it's a really good product in that it really supplements the soil with particulates that will break down more slowly over time and be kind of a slower feeding type of fertilizer. there are spikes that can be put into the ground, sort of artificial for synthetic fertilizer spikes. And these can provide good long-term sort of slow release of the nutrients. But when available, I think that natural products like fish emulsion are really good, too, to consider.
Yeah, I really like fish emulsion, too. I have used that extensively. Keith, there you go. Thank you. Oh, and by the way, just one more question. You mentioned those white wraps. You mm-hmm. take those off in the spring, or do you leave them on?
You should take those off, yeah. Those are best right around when we get into freezing conditions in fall, and then when spring comes, take them right on off.
Thanks, Keith, for calling. Don in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. Yeah, I planted about 2 4-inch cedar trees in the woodsy area of my yard, sandy soil. Wonder, does it do any good to water them when the ground is frozen pretty hard?
Oh, you mean throw some water on now? Oh.
Yeah, Don, that's a good question. I've often wondered that, too, because I have quite a few conifers I've planted in my yard recently, and thinking about this cold snap that's coming, what could I do in addition to the things I've already done in the fall? And I'm not sure I could give any advice on that, because I don't know how it would affect things, and I wouldn't want to cause any harm. So I'd take a cautious approach. One thing you might consider next year is if we do, like it's a sandy soil you're talking about, and you're talking about arborvitae, they are fairly plastic and how much water they like, but I think they would prefer a little bit more on the moist side. So if we have dry seasons like we did last fall, which almost had historically dry fall in Wisconsin in 2024, it's a really good idea to continue that watering of the tree, about an inch of water per week, all the way through until the ground freezes. I should actually say about 2 inches of water per week if it's a young tree that's still establishing. So establishing would be the first maybe 2-3 years. A little bit more water is probably better, especially given an excessive soil. One thing we do know about sandy soils is that because they're more well-drained and can't hold as much moisture, they are more prone to frost development. So a little bit of good water going into the season would be probably a benefit. Now, I guess I'm not sure, so I wouldn't necessarily do that. And I'm not going to do that, even though I've thought about it in my own yard.
Yeah, you wonder if you wind up with a big layer of ice over the top. That would, I just got to believe that wouldn't be good.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah, I think that's a risk.
Don, thank you again. Appreciate it. Renee in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I have 2 pawpaw trees. And one got flowers on this year, and I went and collected pollen from the botanical gardens and pollinated, and I got about 30 little buds of fruit. About 15 survived, and they're all up near the top, and they looked good. We went on vacation for 2 weeks, and they were all gone. Just two green, half-eaten ones on the ground. I'm wondering, what animal might have climbed up that skinny little sapling to get the pawpaw fruits, and what I could do to protect them next year?
Yeah, that sounds like it could be squirrel, possibly. We have been having a lot of squirrel damage in the forest setting up here in northern Wisconsin, particularly with sugar maple, which is not unusual. But I would suspect, with how active squirrels are in kind of a yard setting, that they might have climbed up there and did some feeding. I don't know as much about squirrel as far as how to protect them, because they could probably climb a fence just as easily, too. So, Larry, I don't know. Does that...
Yeah. How large are those pawpaws, Renee?
Oh, this one is about 8 feet tall. The other one hasn't produced any flowers yet. It's much smaller, a different variety. So only about 8 feet tall, and only about, 6 inches around at the base, 4 inches around at the base.
Yeah, that's plenty big enough for a squirrel. I'm betting on squirrels. I was also thinking some types of birds might have done, but there you'd probably have expected to see more parts on the ground of the pawpaw.
I do know that there are some repellents that can be used to deter the feeding by animals, things like squirrels, possibly birds. And these repellents, they're different than anti-desiccants that we're talking about to prevent winter burn or injury. Those are not recommended. But when we're talking about animal damage, repellents can be a useful tool if you have consistent damage or if there's just too many plants to try to protect with that metal mesh. So I would maybe look into that a little bit, possibly the application of a repellent over the winter. Usually I've read one application can be effective unless we get maybe a rain event, which isn't as common. Yeah, apart from that, I'm not sure.
Worth a look, Renee. Thank you very much for calling. And I was reminded that the Savannah Institute is doing a lot of pawpaw research. And Renee, you might just go online to type in the Savannah Institute, and there may be some other information there as well. So be worth a look anyway. Savannah Institute. Les in Gordon, Wisconsin. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Les.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
All right. Back in September, early September, I planted about 35, 40 red pine trees, anywhere from 5 feet to 7 feet tall. I had a good root base, probably 4 feet in diameter. I put down, dug the hole, put down some black dirt, put a little bit of fertilizer in there, covered it up with black dirt, watered the heck out of it all September and October till it got cold. And after it got cold, I waited for about 2 weeks. And I covered it with straw, all the roots there at the bottom of the tree. The trees are nice and green and stuff. I was just wondering, is there anything else I should be doing to those trees?
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question, Les. It sounds like you took all the steps you needed to do. And I know up in Gordon, it's very sandy. So extra water was really a good approach. You know, time will tell with these. I think you set them up for success. When we're talking about, you know, conifers, somewhat red pine, if they're close to a road where they might be exposed to salt spray, that might be a consideration. I'm guessing maybe that's not the case. But if they were, you can put some burlap around them and kind of stake it in and provide some protection. That can also be helpful for winter burn, too. So let's talk about that for a second. Burlap barriers can be useful to prevent this kind of winter burn and also the effects of excess sun if applied either on the windward side and on the side where there's more sun exposure. So that burlap is basically just like it's almost like a jacket around the tree. It's not touching the tree, but it's a few inches off. And it's not encapsulating the tree there. It's open at the top. What it's doing is it's preventing as much sunlight from hitting that foliage, and it's also preventing very drying winds from hitting the foliage too. Yours are 5 to 7 feet tall, so that's a lot of burlap. So maybe it's not economical to do, but in general, smaller trees, I would say a burlapped barrier could be a really good approach just to take extra precaution up against that cold wind and sun in the winter. But other than that, I think you're good. Come spring, more monitoring and a lot of water in that real well-drained soil around the Gordon area.
Yeah, absolutely. Les, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Andrea in Madison, let's go to you now. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Hey, Paul. It's Andrea. I wanted to suggest with that woman who had the squirrel problem, she might consider bagging the fruit. There's an interesting article at the University of Wisconsin-Madison site, the extension site, on bagging fruit. And it's mainly proposed for apples for insect and disease control. You put paper or plastic bags around developing fruit, and it keeps the pests and diseases away. But it might be used to deter those squirrels. If you put a animal repellent on the fruit, you won't want to eat it either.
Yeah, I mean, that's decent points. And we're talking about that pawpaw problem that we talked about earlier. Paul, what do you think?
I would defer to Andrea. I've worked with her for almost 10 years, and she is more the expert than I. So love that she called in. And I would go with that. It does seem like some common sense there to bag the fruit. and keep squirrels and potentially other animals away. So I like that idea, and I do think repellents, it's a good point, would deter one's interest in human consumption of the fruit.
We have callers coming on. You mentioned wind, though, and wind certainly can cause problems. If we have, let's talk wind damage, because we've had some extreme wind events. Is it okay to prune it off this time of year? I would think it would be.
Yeah, that comes into another form of damage we see, which is heavy snow loading and potential damage from freezing rain. We haven't really had that yet, but we really don't know if we will. And so, yes, I think pruning damaged limbs off is a good idea, number one, for safety. That's probably the biggest prerogative there. And then number two, pruning right now in the winter is a really good time, because there's fewer insect and diseases that could colonize and infect those sites where it's been pruned. And also there's some research
to show that
pruning
or comment
in the winter can facilitate the formation of that wound tissue that grows around and closes off the wound over time. So absolutely, broken branches that might be hanging, if there's a main stem that's kind of got a crack in it because there was a two stems, co-dominant stems, and one may have split, it's a good time to get that out of there. And then general pruning and maintenance care, it's a good time right now. So yeah, really good to do that kind of stuff now before we get into the warm period again, right around April.
Margaret in Fort Atkinson, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I'm an oak tree lover, and I have, I would call it a young adult in my front yard, and I know that oak trees tend to lose their leaves later or not at all. But just up the street, there's two oak trees that are still have their leaves, and mine dropped their leaves. And I didn't know if it had to do with the health of the tree or.
And do you have red oaks or white oaks? Or?
I have a bur oak.
Bur oak.
And the one up the street is a bur oak also.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I do know that effect of kind of differential leaf loss and how much leaves fall in the fall has to do with the species. We do see like the northern pin oak tend to retain more of its leaves into the winter. But between the same species of oak, I'm not really sure. There might be some kind of physiological differences at the genetic level. But we also could see some stress on one or the other of the oak. One thing we do see a lot of when we see leaves that hang on into the fall, late into the fall or winter, is an indication that the tree might have been attacked by a native insect we call the two-lined chestnut borer. Typically, branches and twigs attacked by that insect earlier in the summer tend to keep their leaves on for about 6 to 10 months after the attack. And so while it can look like it's just brown leaves hanging on the tree naturally, it might actually be the sign of attack. In the case of bur oak, I'm less concerned about that because bur oak is not quite as tasty for the two-lined chestnut borer. So I'm really not sure. I think it could be some genetic differences, could be some differences in maybe soil moisture as those trees went into the dormant period. But I don't think it's anything to really be too concerned about unless we were talking about a red oak. Yeah,
there you go, Margaret. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Martha in Madison had called but couldn't stay with us. She's looking for to buy a mountain ash tree and wonders why she can't find one and wonders if is it okay to order online.
Yeah, that would be just fine. I think there's some good retailers out there that sell mountain ash. I haven't seen their inventory specifically. I think some of the nurseries down in around Milwaukee area and Madison might have some mountain ash. I would call around, see what you can find. Mountain ash is a very good urban tree, very good for birds because of the berries and pretty hardy to the urban environment. But yeah, mountain ash is a great species. And the biggest bonus with mountain ash, perhaps, is it's not susceptible to emerald ash borer because it's not a true ash. So it has that going for it. And yeah, if you can find it, by all means, go for it.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the emerald ash borer because I wanted to ask you about it. What's the latest on the emerald ash borer?
Yeah, so the last time we talked, I think in September, Larry, we had all 72 counties with a positive detection of EAB about 20 years after we first found it in the state. So that was a big milestone we hit. but it's sort of, it's business as usual with the emerald ash borer. It is spreading throughout Wisconsin. The impacts are really heavy in the southern half of Wisconsin, where we generally see most of the ash forest and ash trees in the urban setting, either dead from EAB attack or in sharp decline. Whereas in the north, it's still slower to move around, probably because of a little bit cooler weather and harsher conditions and less people really traveling and moving it. But it's still spreading in the north. We're seeing mortality in the various stands. It's just a little bit slower to happen. You know, when we think about this big cold snap that's coming up, of course, we know that some level of mortality to the emerald ash borer larvae and pre-pupate that are underneath the bark can happen, but it's really not going to happen at too much of a meaningful level. So we can't really rest our hat on this upcoming cold snap and think we can change course with the EAB management plans we have maybe in our forest or for our yard tree. We want to stay the course. If we're talking about protecting a yard ash, now is a great time to consider contacting an arborist and getting on a schedule for an insecticide treatment of the tree later on this spring or early summer. And if we're doing forest management or haven't done any yet, it's still a good time to contact a certified forester or a plan writer and develop a plan to assess the forest and write a management plan to cope with the impacts of EAB, whether that's planting some non-ash species or whether that's reducing the ash stocking to reduce your overall, you know, vulnerability to the impact. So we're still hitting this issue head on, but it's one of persistence, and it's going to take a lot of time before all the ash are largely killed, at most of them at least, and before we have some good regrowth of the other trees.
Always interesting here in southern Wisconsin, driving around in spring, especially the last few years. Once the trees just start to leaf out, you can see where the ash trees are because they're not leafing out.
Yeah, old skeleton canopies left behind. It's really a sad situation. But fortunately, on the DNR's website, we've got plenty of information about people always want to do something. And so that's what we've got. We've got options and we've got action plans for people to implement, whether they're in a forest or whether they have a yard tree. So it's not a situation we're completely have to be resigned to. There's a lot of proactive work that can still be done to get, you know, to do our best against this infestation.
And one last thing, you did mention pruning, but this really is a good time to get out there and prune.
Absolutely. I think, you know, right now, you know, arborists are generally, they're not as busy. It's really hard sometimes in the summer to find an arborist because their schedules are so booked up. I know where I am. The folks that I talk to, they talk about, you know, being months and months, sometimes 6 months out before getting on the list of getting some service. And so right now is a good time where there's probably a little bit slower period, and it's good to spread that work out. And it's just better for the trees to be doing the work now. You can see the architecture, so the pruning can be done more soundly. You can do it in a time where there's less risk. And it's just, yeah, now's the time to do it. And even if you're not thinking about trees, winter is a good time to think about them.
For sure. Paul, lots of calls today. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks,
very
Larry.
Much.
Have a great weekend.
You as well. Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. He's one of our regular guests, and it's always fun to talk with Paul. Well, we're going to turn our attention indoors next and talk about lighting for your plants, indoor plants, among other things. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. Well, whether you're growing tropicals, herbs, or maybe you're just overwintering a plant that goes back outside in the spring, you need to provide the right amount of light. And now on Garden Talk, we'll get some tips and techniques for keeping your inside plants happy with light and other things as well. Certainly, you can join in with your questions as we visit with Leslie Halleck. She is a horticulture business owner, an educator, communicator, and author, including one of her books, is Gardening Under Lights, The Complete Guide for Indoor Growers. Leslie has more than 30 years of professional experience working in different segments of horticulture and a whole lot of training. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about growing under lights? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Leslie Halleck, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey there, Wisconsin. It's been a little bit since I got to do some good old terrestrial call-in radio, which I love. So I'm happy to be on things.
And, you know, you've spent a lot of time in this area. I think you had a master's degree, do you not, from Michigan State?
I did. You know, I lived in Syracuse. I grew up in Germany, spent my master's degree time in Michigan State. So I know what it likes to be a little chilly. You know, I know thank goodness I was doing greenhouse research at Michigan State for my master's degree. So I got to sit under my high pressure sodium lamps, simulating sunlight while it was, you know, negative 18 degrees outside. So that's the way to do it, man. That's the way to do it.
Oh, man. Well, you're sort of a horticultural renaissance woman, I think. Where'd you get your love of plants?
Oh, boy. That's, you know, I think that all of us have a seed planted by a parent, a grandparent, a neighbor, whomever it is that is into gardening and plants at some point in our childhood. And for some of us, that seed germinates. You know, later I was an art major in college for a couple of years. That was really my life goal. But my mother had always gardened. And growing up in Germany, we lived in small villages. I'm an army brat, but we never lived on post or base. We always lived out on what we call the economy. And I would always seek out, because I didn't have relatives close, I didn't have a grandma, I would seek out the ladies in the villages or wherever we lived, who were kind of on their own, and they puttered out in their gardens. They gardened, and I would just start showing up at their houses. And, you know, and so they, you know, conscripted me into gardening service. So between my mom gardening and me, you know, being a nuisance to all the neighbor ladies who, you know, just figured they'd put me to work in their garden, you know, that seed germinated and kicked in for me in college. So at about 19, I changed my major to botany. And immediately went and found a small independent garden center on the edge of my college town called the Green Fiddler, which is a great name. And I walked in and I said, hey, I'm a botany major. I want to work here. And the owner was a woman, Carol Watson. And she said, okay, see those plants over there? Grab a hose and start watering. And that was the beginning of my professional horticulture career. True story. So, short story, but short.
But a great story. Jeff in Door County already has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good afternoon, you guys. I've got a couple of peace lilies. They're quite large, probably 3 feet tall, 4.5 by 5 feet around. And they're a couple of 3 years old, and they're no longer flowering. And I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong. They look healthy otherwise.
Well, you're not doing anything wrong. It's just that, you know, flowering plants have certain environmental conditions that are conducive for them to flower. And flowering takes a lot of energy. So in the winter, obviously, natural light levels are, you know, about half the intensity that we get in the summer. And day lengths are much shorter. The photo period is shorter. So once you bring plants inside, you know, the humidity is very low in the winter. None of these conditions are conducive to blooming. So if your plants are inside over the winter, chances are they're not getting enough light to really produce enough energy via photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is going to slow down. And so the energy that plant has to make very expensive things like flowers and seeds is limited. Fertilizer can't substitute light. So fertilizing them isn't necessarily going to help that. Generally speaking, once day lengths start to get a little longer, light quantity increases, which you could provide supplementally via grow lights. So if your goal is to really get those spaths to bloom again, you're going to have to provide more food, right, in form of light, so that plant has enough calories, right, to make enough energy to make those flowers.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us at talk@wpr.org. Maybe before we take some more questions, tell us about your business, Halleck Horticulture.
Halleck Horticultural. Horticulture, that's a mouthful, right? And when I tell somebody I'm a horticulturist, you know, a lot of people haven't even heard that word. So I have a long, varied career in the industry from plant ecology research, public gardens, landscape design and maintenance, spent many years in garden center retail. I love garden center retail. And about 12, 13 years ago, I said, you know, I know how to do a lot of these things. I know how to run these businesses profitably. So I'm going to outsource myself. So I took my business, Halleck Horticultural, full time. I have a few different ways I work. Obviously, I write books and teach for hobbyists, gardening and plant hobbyists, and professionals learning to grow their skills. So I teach horticulture courses through UCLA Extension and in other venues, write books for the public. And then on the back end, have worked for many years with horticulture green industry businesses. So I help them with business development, communications, marketing, growing their businesses. These days, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of career transitioners and entrepreneurs looking to grow their business in the horticulture industry. So I keep one foot in the garden. I do horticulture consulting, and I teach enthusiasts about plants and gardening, and my other foot is in your business. So it's helping people run business in a nutshell.
That's pretty cool. Well, let's get into more about growing plants inside.
Sure.
What should you know before you bring a plant home?
Well, I think in the context of a conversation about light, one of the things you really need to take into consideration is when you bring a plant home, it's automatically going to be going into a place with much less light quantity and probably intensity than under which it was grown. So that's a big shift when people, and this is, you know, this could be the opposite sometimes for the garden. Sometimes if you're putting a plant outside in the garden, you know, in a really hot location, you know, it might be getting more light. But generally when we're talking about the indoor garden, people tend to struggle when they bring that plant home. And then that first few weeks, it starts to look a little bit more peaked, and they're not sure what they're doing wrong. And again, it's not that you're necessarily doing anything wrong. It's that plant was getting ideal light conditions, right? It was getting enough energy to photosynthesize and make the food, essentially, that it needs to thrive. Bring it inside where light levels are exponentially lower, regardless of what your eyeballs think is the truth. And we can talk a little bit about that, because that's usually not the truth. You have a way less light in your house. Generally speaking, inside your home, you're going to have much, much less light than you would even a shady spot out in your yard. You're going to get a lot more light out in that shady spot than outside than you are in your home. So generally speaking, you want to make sure that you are not bringing home plants that need full sun, high light, you know, heavy bloomers into a home with no supplemental lighting, because generally that's a recipe for decline. And that's why so many people fail with succulents and cacti inside. Generally, folks think, oh, I overwatered it and killed it. You're not overwatering it. You're underlighting it. If the plant had enough light quantity and intensity, then that same amount of water wouldn't kill it. It's when there's not enough light there and you water it, that plant can't photosynthesize and utilize it, so it sits and rots.
How do you tell? I mean, I can think back to light meters that photographers have used. I mean, how do you know if you've got enough light for your plants?
Yeah, most people, obviously, eyeballs gauge brightness. And a light meter for photography that measures lumens or lux also is measuring brightness to the human eye. Well, plants don't have eyeballs. That's not how plants perceive or use light. Plants harvest photons of light, right? And they absorb that in through their leaves and in the cells. And so basically, I equate it to a rain cloud and raindrops. Light photons are like the raindrops, right? They can be dense, they can be sparse, there can be a lot at once, or it can be thinned out. And that's your light intensity and light quantity. So it's a numeric function, right? It's a quantity function of light versus what you perceive as brightness. And oftentimes the eyeball perceives green light as more bright than the other colors of light, whereas red and blue spectrums of light are bigger drivers of photosynthesis in plants. So what you perceive as a bright location in your home really is, usually I'm going to say that's a low light location. So lux meters or photography meters or the meters that are on an iPhone, they can give you a general idea of brightness for your space. But if you really want to nerd out and measure actual light quantity that plants can use, that's when you go to something called a quantum flux meter. It makes me really popular at parties, let me tell you. So quantum flux meters can actually sense the units, the numbers of light photons that are hitting that space in a square meter. So if you want to get really technical about it, yes, you can actually measure the amount of light your plant is actually getting or not getting. But that takes a more sensitive sensor that measures in the right units, and that's a quantum flux meter. But those lux meters or lumens meters or the meters you can use on your phone will at least give you an idea of whether you have a bright, not so bright, or not bright at all location. And that can help be a good guide for you.
How much do one of those quantum plus meters cost?
So the least expensive quality quantum flux meter that I can recommend is about $300, and that's InnoQuest. The ones I use are generally $500-$600 and up. So unless you're a professional, you're generally not going to be using those. But if you're doing interior scaping or you're doing houseplant care for people, then that meter is going to be super helpful for you. If you have a greenhouse, if you grow a lot of plants at home, you grow a lot of transplants for your garden, then yeah, that might make sense. But if you just have some houseplants, then there's meters on your phone that measure in lux and will convert that and will just tell you general ideas of brightness.
Holly in Ogama in Price County, Wisconsin, has a question. Let's go there. Holly, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes. I've had a Hoya for years, and I think it's been transplanted into a bigger pot once. The bottom leaves always get yellow and look horrible, but where the tendrils go up underneath my window, they're bright green, and I get lots of blooms. What am I doing wrong?
So it sounds to me like the lower part of the plant is not getting as much light as the top part of the plant or the ends of your stems. Is that correct?
Well, it's in a south window.
Well, so but remember that we're talking about light photons, and the further you get away from the direct light source, so say your pot is sitting just below that window ledge. The top part of your plant is benefiting from a lot more light than the bottom part of the plant. It could be shaded out by the other leaves that are further up the plant. So it's very common for plants to shed lower leaves if not as much light is penetrating down to those lower leaves. Those leaves then become inefficient at photosynthesis, so the plant sheds them. So when you don't have even light distribution, right, down that plant, you often lose lower leaves. Sometimes yellowing and losing lower leaves can be a water management issue, say if the Hoya was staying a little too wet. But if the top of the plant is growing and blooming and you're losing lower leaves, then it's probably natural shedding due to the base of that plant not getting quite as much light as the top of the plant. That's pretty common.
Holly, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Leslie Halleck, our guest today. The book that we've been kind of talking about is Gardening Under Lights, the complete guide for indoor growers, taking your indoor plant questions today. The number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Leslie Halleck, our guest today on Garden Talk, her book, she has many books, Gardening Under Lights, the one we've kind of zeroed in on, Gardening Under Lights, the complete guide for indoor growers. Give a call with your questions, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Got an email from Jordan. He's trying to germinate native perennial plants in his basement. He's in southern Wisconsin. He's building a DIY grow rack with LED lights. He's got 4,500K and 6,500K LED lights mixed with the blue diodes. His understanding is that blue is good for vegetation. What about a light that should be targeted for these seedlings in maybe PPF or PPFD measurements?
Sure. So sounds like he's on the way, or on the way to doing this correctly. So generally speaking, yes, blue light tends to favor vegetative growth, the blue light spectrum. It keeps plants denser. It keeps internet length shorter, so plants don't get leggy. Red light tends to trigger a flowering response, an elongation response. We also call this a shade avoidance response. And so what you don't want to do when you're starting seedlings is work with lights that are really red heavy. And that may be down below that 4,500 K Kelvin range. And so the 4,500 to 6,500 is good. Usually when I'm starting seedlings, I like to go a little bluer. So I like to be up around that, more in that 6,000 over 5,000 Kelvin, which is really a color temperature rating, so cooler or warmer. And that will help your seedlings not elongate too much. Generally, seedlings in that first 2 to 5 week period need a PPFD, or photosynthetic photon flux density. That means the intensity of light hitting those leaves, of about 200 to 300 micromoles per meter squared. And it sounds like Jordan knows kind of what we're talking about, so he'll be able to figure that out. With a DLI of around 15 moles per meter square per day for that first, for those first few weeks. And that may be accomplished by running those particular, I don't know if they're 40, 45 watt LED bars, running those for, you know, around 16 hours a day. I have calculations for figure out how to do that in my book, Gardening Under Light. So, and I also have a bunch of stuff on my blog. I can send you some links for if you want to offer those to your listeners. But Jordan probably should stick to the cooler spectrum whilst in that earlier germination growing period. Once you are potting up those plants to bigger pots, you could go down to the 4,500 or the 5,000 range, and that would be fine. But I'd stick to the cooler spectrum, 200, 300 micromoles per meter square for PPFD, a DLI target of 15 moles per meter square per day. And I think Jordan will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and probably most people don't know what you and Jordan were talking about there. But, you know, when I bought a plant, I bring it home.
Yep.
I want to put an LED light on it maybe.
Sure.
What, you know, where do you kind of start on that?
Yeah, most folks are going to be in the situation where they buy a houseplant, right? They have a few, or that few houseplants, and clearly light is not, intense or abundant enough to keep those plants happy. Generally speaking, there are some good spotlight LEDs. So this is where we get into the lower wattage, 20 to 40 spotlight LEDs. There are some nicer ones that come in really nice cases that are integrated that you can buy. A GE makes a really good 36 watt, I believe, grow bulb that comes in warm and cool spectrum. You can plug those directly into a house lamp or a spotlight. And depending on how close that spotlight is or how high it is, you'll get more intense light if it's closer with a smaller footprint. So maybe you want to have that pepper plant inside, right, that you brought in from the garden and want to keep alive, or, you know, just general house plants or succulents. If you raise that light up, you're going to get less intense light, a bigger footprint. So, you know, if you have medium light plants, that's great. If you have succulents and high light plants, you want that light closer for more intense light. So you play with the distance of that spotlight, and then you play with how long you run it. For general house plants, you know, you may just really need to run that grow lamp for an extra 3 or 4 hours a day to extend the day length and get that extra quantity of light. You'll just have to experiment with that in your own home. But those spotlight LEDs in that 20 to 40 watt range are generally adequate for most people's needs when you're just trying to keep some houseplants happy, right, in that dark corner of your house.
My lime tree, Limey, I had sort of a tree lamp with three sections going up and down and so I had grow lights in all of those of the type you were just mentioning, and it worked pretty well. Because I got
those work pretty well.
I got light all the way down, up and down the tree that way.
Yeah, and that's the trick, is that sometimes with the spotlights, you're getting that light all in the top canopy of the plant, and then you can start to lose lower leaves because that light's not penetrating as far down. So, you know, using the light stands that have several fixtures on it, right? High level, medium, and then lower. Allow you to, if you're going to keep a citrus plant inside, they need a lot of light. So one, 20, 30 watt grow light isn't going to do it. You got to ramp that up.
Is it important to turn the lights off at night?
Yeah, you don't really want to run your garlic 24 hours. In fact, there most plants will get to a point of kind of capacity limitation, you know, a saturation point where they really can't use any more light. And then they're going to be respirating, using resources more than they're able to replace that with photosynthesis. So there's some crops like peppers that you can actually get away with growing under 24 hours of light without losing productivity. But most plants, you know, you're going to be fine with a photo period from anywhere from, you know, 12 hours to 16 hours. So it just depends on what you're growing. If you have houseplants and it's bright, if you've got light in your house most of the day, but in winter, you know, it's getting dark at 4:35, then you turn your grow lights on at the end of the day and run them for 3-4 hours to get your plants enough light. So no, you don't want to leave them on 24 hours a day. You want to use a little timer, and that helps you not forget, especially with your seedlings.
Leslie, tell us about, you mentioned your blog. Tell us about your blog and how we can get to it. We can put a link up on our site too, but talk about it a bit.
Yeah, everything is on my website, LeslieHallick.com, LeslieHallick. And there's a blog tab on there, and I've probably got, I think I have, gosh, probably 17 years worth of blogging. There's some old school stuff on there, and I've deleted a lot of it that was old, but I have topics on there, I mean, gosh, that range anything from outdoor to indoor gardening. And I have some posts. There's a search box down at the bottom of my website. You can search grow lights. I have a really great comprehensive post, 10 steps to growing tiny tomatoes indoors year-round. So if you just search micro tomatoes or grow tomatoes indoors, there's lots of good posts that give you the kind of light information I was giving Jordan. So feel free to use the search box at LeslieHallick.com, and you can find lots of different gardening info.
And maybe tell us a little bit about your work as a UCLA Extension instructor in the Horton Gardening program there.
Yeah, so, you know, when the pandemic hit, many educational institutions were looking at how to take their education, right, and their classes online because we had to. So UCLA contacted me in 2020 and said, hey, we need somebody to develop and teach courses on indoor plants, indoor maintenance. So that was my first course with them in 2020, as I built a really comprehensive indoor plants care and maintenance. So if you want to take a deep dive into like real light science and really how to do all of this inside, especially if you have a desire to maybe do that professionally, my indoor plants course is great for that. I also teach a botany course, so a botany course for gardeners. So that's a really great in-depth course if you're looking to really learn about how plants work. And this last fall, I debuted 2 horticulture business courses. So I have the business of horticulture, which I run in the spring and fall. And it really teaches you all about the industry, you know, if you're looking to transfer into the industry or start a business. And then currently I'm teaching my follow-up course about the business of selling plants. So, you know, plant shops, garden centers, if this is a dream of yours, I really teach you how to do this profitably. So again, I'm going to teach you the horticulture, and then I'm going to teach you how to run your business.
That sounds great. Yes. Can anybody sign up for these?
Yeah, they are. Oh, the great thing about it is that they're really professional level classes, but hobbyists are welcome. It's open registration. So just look up UCLA Extension Horticulture. You'll find the program and all the courses. And yes, anybody can register. And I have the great thing about it being online is I have students from all over. I have some students right now from Canada. I think I have a student from Wisconsin. I get students from Europe, so no matter where you are, you can join any of my courses through UCLA Extension.
Boy, this has been a lot of fun. I'm sorry we're out of time, Leslie. Would you be willing to come back and be with us again?
Sure. I know, you know, people have tons of houseplant questions, and it can be really complicated and frustrating sometimes. So, yeah, I'm happy to come back and help.
Leslie, thank you so much. And your site again is
LeslieHallick.com.
LeslieHallick.com. Thank you so much. I look forward to another visit. Thank you. Leslie Hallick, our guest. Great to have her with us on Garden Talk, and great to have you listening in. This and all of our shows are a team effort, of course. We had 3 topics we dealt with today, so kept our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, busy today. And we've got a couple of other busy people, too. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, and a couple of busy technical directors as well, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, who was on the board today. Great to have them as well. And thank you for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in stir here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.